Welcome back to another episode of More Than a Monolith. Let me start with a little bit of good and bad news. The bad news is that this is the last episode of season two. However, the good news is we have an amazing guest to close us out. Today, my guest is Estella Awima Church, Executive Director of Empowering Pacific Islander Communities, also known as EPIC. Estella is a former educator of nearly two decades and is a strong voice and advocate for marginalized communities, having spoken all over the world about pressing education matters. This was a heavy conversation for me because I could feel the depth of critical urgency Estella leads with every day. In our conversation, we talk about the lack of representation in education, data desegregation, the lack of care for our Pacific Islander communities, and so much more. We encourage you to continue the conversation with us by sharing this episode and tagging us on Twitter or LinkedIn. Today's episode is sponsored by SoundMind, an immersive wellness platform students can use as a mind management tool for emotional and physical wellness using music therapy. Used by over 250,000 students across the nation, SoundMind is the leading mental health app for youth, including recently named one of the top six mental health apps for kids by Parents Magazine. You can learn more and access their mental health toolkit by visiting www.soundmind.app. Welcome, Estella Awima Church, to the More Than a Monolith podcast.
Thank you for having me.
I'm really excited to have you here, and I know you are super busy traveling all across the country, so I appreciate you making time to have this conversation today.
Yeah, of course.
So the first thing we like to do is just help you and the audience get acquainted with one another. So I'd love for you to just maybe tell us a little bit about you, your story, and then maybe at the end, tell us about EPIC.
Okay. Yeah. So Estella Awima Church, I am, or pronoun she, her, and I was raised on Tongva lands, for now known as Los Angeles. And, before taking up the role as executive director of EPIC, I served as an educator for the last 10 years in the classroom as high school theater educator, and before that, college counselor, and among several other roles and titles over the last couple of decades. But yeah, have been an educator for quite some time.
Yeah, you've lived like nine lives already.
As a classroom teacher? Yeah, for sure.
Yes. And you have so many other facets to your story. And I'm going to make sure we link your actual bio to the show notes because you're pretty incredible. And I know you probably won't brag on yourself, but my goodness, like the history that you bring to EPIC and to your work, it's incredible. I'm sitting here with you. I'm like, wow, she is amazing.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
Of course. Well, I have a number of topics I want to explore with you today as it centers in on the Pacific Island community. So I'm just going to let this go wherever it takes, but I want to start with your work as a classroom teacher and with the topic around representation. We talk a lot about the Asian American side and there not being enough representation, but if we do some deep data dives, we're going to see far less on the Pacific Islander side. So talk to me a little bit about just representation when it comes to the PI community and what your takeaways are from where we go from here.
As a classroom teacher and union member leader for California Teachers Association and for National Education Association, it was quite difficult to find other Native Hawaiian and PI educators just to connect with. And I actively sought out folks. I was engaged in our caucuses for Asian Pacific Americans and ICTA, as well as at the national level, and served as a delegate to APALA on behalf of our education unions And more often than not, I was the only PI in any and every room I got to be in. Not to say that there aren't other educators out there, but it's definitely difficult to find one another in, what's the word? I guess I'd say in traditional educator spaces, tough to find our folks. When I chose to become a classroom teacher, I made a very conscious decision to go back to the neighborhood I grew up in, neighborhood nearest where my mom was raised, assuming that that's where I would find PI students to serve. And I should also say, my mother is Samoan, her family from Savai, Samoa. My father is from Calabar, Nigeria. And so I am Samoan Black. And I thought, well, yeah, I'm gonna go to this to South LA, and where I grew up, knowing other PI kids and other Black kids and other PI Black kids, assuming that that's where I would get to serve. And when I got back home to teach, not a lot of PI students on campus. I think my first year in the classroom, I want to say there were 5 PI students on campus. And there were a whole lot more before. And so it was a big shock for me. And I, you know, over the years, just tried to figure out, like, where are the kids going? Where are our families going if they're not here at school? And the issue of data disaggregation became very obvious in the fact that we don't have access to disaggregated data for students, for families, or educators. So students aren't being counted, therefore their needs aren't being met. And so parents are looking for other options.
Mm-hmm. I want to go to data desegregation in a moment, but circling back to just your teaching experience, I'm really curious. I'm guessing you probably didn't see a lot of representation when you were a student in K-12. So I'm curious what led you to go into education yourself?
That's an interesting question. And actually, so I was pretty privileged and fortunate. My parents put me in it was a small, independent Black school connected to one of the churches we visited when I was a kid. I grew up at a nearly all Black private school of other working class families. And so while there was no PI representation, I definitely felt seen and held and represented at this all Black school. When I left that school and attended public high school after, because I grew up at the school from preschool, kindergarten, all the way through to middle school. And so when I left and went to public high school, LAUSD, that was the first time I was rudely awakened to not just lack of representation, but absolute disregard for Black students, for PI students, for anyone who was not white, to be honest. And I was supposed to go into the magnet at my high school that I was at. I was labeled as gifted early on, and coming from the school that I grew up at, I was a little bit ahead of most of my peers. And I started high school when I was 12. And when my dad and I showed up to the school to register for classes and for the magnet, they immediately said, oh, absolutely not. No. And sent me to a sheltered program. And at the time, it was a year-round school. So they took me off of the traditional track, put me on the B track, and had put me in a sheltered program for newcomers, totally making the assumption that I did not speak English. Wow. And it took a long time for my teachers, luckily I had some great teachers I'm still close to, who had to advocate on my behalf, because my dad would just say, you know, well, they're the experts. They should know better. So I'm going to listen to them. Mm-hmm. And I'm over here like, Dad, no, something's wrong with this class. I'm not supposed to be in this English class. And it took, my other teachers who fought for me to get me into the right classes. But that started off my high school years pretty rough. And I went from bringing home straight A's to failing every single class.
Yeah.
And nearly did not make it out of high school. And I had a college counselor say to me when I was gearing up for that process, on my college list, it was NYU, Spelman, and then a few other schools. And I was the biggest drama geek on campus. Theater was everything to me. I became a theater teacher. And I had a pretty extensive portfolio at that time. And so I thought, NYU, that's where I'm going. That's where all the drama geeks go. I'm going to be on Broadway. And my college counselor looked at the list and said, no, the magnet students couldn't get in. What makes you think you can get in? And she looks down at the list and she's like, well, Spelman's there. At least you're Black. You've got that going for you. And I was devastated, crushed. And I remember running out of her office, trying really hard not to cry in front of her. And I ran back to my stage crew and my drama teacher and I cried with them because I didn't know what else to do. And that was when I made the decision to become a counselor. And I went right back to my high school to be a college counselor for a Gear Up program, same Gear Up program I was in. And it was the students in my caseload, actually, who had convinced me to become a classroom educator because I was pretty dead set on going into public policy and serving in education in that from that capacity. And it was my kiddos, class of 2011, who, I mean, they spent weeks convincing me. They were like, no, you need to be in the classroom like full time. Like imagine if we got to spend more time with you than as our counselor, we see you every once in a while, but be a classroom teacher. And then I was like, okay, you convinced me. And I switched my grad school applications and made the choice to go ahead and put everything into being a classroom educator.
Wow. Okay. Here's my next question for you. So thank you for sharing that part of your story, because that is, my eyes are wide over here as you're talking about that. But in reality, those stories are happening all over our public education system all the time. So I'm really curious, just your personal opinion. Are you looking to increase that representation of PI adults in the system, or are you cautiously encouraging that because of your personal experience? So is it a call to action or is it a warning?
Dang. I'm 6 months out of the classroom. Had you asked me maybe 9 months ago, I think my immediate answer would be to get more of us in classrooms. But after choosing to leave, and as I still grieve that loss, I know that students need to see teachers who look like them. And I want that for kids. But what I don't want for anyone is to be trapped in a system like the public education system and get to the places I've been emotionally the last couple of years. Like, I just don't want that for anyone. And
yeah,
I don't want any educator who loves what they do to ever feel the way to get to the point where I had to make the choice to leave.
Mm-hmm.
So that's a really hard question for me to answer right now. I want students to be totally successful and have everything that they need to thrive. And I know that that includes having PI teachers. I know that that includes having Black teachers. I know that that includes having Black male teachers.
Yeah.
And in my last year in the classroom, we lost 3 Black men on our campus in one school year, neither related to COVID. And all I kept finding myself saying every day as I walked into my classroom was, I don't want to die. And feeling like it was inevitable. I mean, like, I know it's inevitable, but it felt like it could be any freaking second.
Yeah.
And I'm a teacher. I'm a high school teacher. Like, what? That's not a, like, dying from stress on the job is not.
Yeah.
That is not what my teacher prep program prepared me for. And not once did anyone mention that, that that's where I would be in my last year in the classroom.
So if Estella ruled the world, had her own district, was a superintendent, what would support for our Pacific Islander teachers, our Black teachers, what would that look like to you? Because it's one thing to recruit them, but I don't think we do enough to retain and support them. So what would that look like to you?
I think retention in most careers, and especially in education, retention means that we have access to high quality mentors who also look like us and share our values. Teachers, or, you know, seasoned educators who will be honest and who can give us the good and the bad and the in between. It would look like not asking brand new professionals to work for free and putting us at a major disadvantage. And you know, I'm the first in my family to graduate from high school, to graduate from college, to earn a higher ed degree. And it definitely took a ton of student loans to do it. And so going into teaching, like, to become a teacher, you make the conscious choice. Poverty is what I'm choosing because I want to be an educator. And so you start your career out working for free, a full-time job that goes far beyond contract hours for free. You begin your career in debt from student loans, and then the debt piles on for that first year in the classroom because you are struggling to pay rent and make ends meet. And then probably having to pick up jobs in addition to your full-time classroom work. That's messed up. And I don't even know how it got to be that way and what policymaker thought that makes total sense and why in 2023 that is still the case. I know a lot of folks have gotten their debt relieved, but I am still struggling with that. And I know a lot of folks who still are. And I know for many communities of color, women, we tend to hold that student loan debt at higher rates. And many of us, again, the first in our families to do it. And so there's no one in our families we can lean on financially or to help navigate the system because no one's ever done it before in our families. And so, you know, it looks like having financial support and assistance and planning access to it, that because, you know, we've never needed it before. And it looks like being able to afford a freaking house in the neighborhood you serve in. Like, I taught and lived in my neighborhood, my hometown, and I will never be able to afford housing in my community. And that's, like, really depressing every time I think about it. There were many times I just cried because I have a family. I'm trying to take care of them. As a first gen daughter of immigrants, it is my job to take care of my parents. And I know that, like, clock is ticking and I need to retire my father. And I don't have a house to retire into. And that is really painful, all because I made the choice to serve. So there's a lot of guilt and shame there. And then on the other side of it, there's still a ton more guilt and shame for choosing to leave.
We had spoken previously about the debt idea for PI women specifically, the significant debt that they carry. because they choose careers of care, yet the reciprocal is not happening. They're caring and no one's caring about them. Is there any way out of that?
I hope so. I hope so.
Do you think that's grounded in cultural norms to seek out those careers of care?
Part of it, definitely. I wouldn't want to overgeneralize, but I know that for Samoans, service is very much a part of our culture. You serve and you serve without complaining, and you know, you take care of. And it's also very much a part of how I was raised in a Nigerian household. Mm-hmm. It's very much a part of who I am, who my parents were. Even when they don't have, they give. And that's the example they set. And so in both of their houses. And so,
yeah,
definitely it was for me a reason why I chose to serve and why I continue to serve, even though it's quite difficult to do so or to sustain yourself while doing so. I think it's cultural in the sense that our society here in the U.S., continental U.S., is very much rooted in oppression, white supremacy, and capitalism. And many of our communities of color, indigenous communities, many of our peoples are communal and come from collectives that understand mutual aid at their core. And that's not who we are here in the U.S. And so there's a struggle there. There's a you want to hold on to who you are and who your ancestors were, who your ancestors are, and be able to thrive here. Mm-hmm. And sometimes it feels like those two things can exist at the same time. However, I know that it's possible, and it's possible if, when folks of the global majority are able to move in solidarity. And when everyone can show up as good relatives, and when all of our communities can get back to who we were and who our ancestors continue to remind us of who we are, then yeah, maybe somewhere down the line. I have to hope that it is, because I have to hope that all of that is possible, because I have a daughter that I wish I could raise her to only know liberation. But because I've never actually experienced it, I don't actually know that I can give it to her. But I know that we're one generation closer. And maybe four more generations down the line, they'll be able to raise kids to know liberation.
Okay, we're going to take a deep breath. That was a lot. That was heavy. As you're talking, I'm ruminating on that. As we talk about the need for change, it brings up the generational trauma, the cultural trauma that we have to endure in this country as we navigate improvements. And that's hard. That's a hard weight to carry. So I thank you. I thank you for allowing us to have that conversation. I want to talk about the data desegregation piece, because I think that is grounded in so much of being able to make those improvements. Our organization, CAPL, that is high on our priority list when we talk about advocacy with our legislators of breaking from this monolithic concept. You have this big AAPI umbrella, and even if you go Asian American, Pacific Islander, there are still many nuances in there. So I'd really like to just get some thoughts from you on data desegregation and reinforcing why it's so important.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure data disaggregation remains at the top of the list for every API organization. Yes. It unfortunately has been a several decade fight that community leaders across API communities have been demanding for years. It is so necessary because, like you said, the API umbrella is vast. in the Native Hawaiian and Pacific Islander community. Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking over 40 groups of folks and languages and religions and several islands all across the Pacific. There are a lot of us, Polynesian, Micronesian, Melanesian, and each of our issues are different. Mm-hmm. There are plenty of areas where, yeah, we, you know, we can fight together and the struggle is similar, but our issues are different and very different from our Asian siblings. One example that comes to mind is during the pandemic and with the rise of Asian attacks or attacks on Asian folks, the phrase or the hashtag stop API hate. Mm-hmm. When I heard it the first time, it rubbed me the wrong way because I thought, of course, I don't want attacks on Asian folks. Like, no, that's not okay. Mm-hmm. But also hate and violence show up in my community very differently. I'm not concerned about, or I should say I'm least concerned about a random attack on the street than I am concerned about the sheriff department. Mm-hmm. And whether or not I'm getting pulled over, or that's what I'm more concerned about. That's how violence shows up in my neighborhood. So that's one of several issues that I think impacts our communities differently. In the classroom, the model minority myth, while a problem, often is used, how do I say, the bias of an educator. They might be quicker to assume an Asian student is going to be a good student and will not be anti-authority or talk back or disruptive. And so they may put more time into that student. An Asian student might be fast-tracked. Mm-hmm. Based on that model minority myth, straight into an honors or an AP course. Whereas as a Black student, as a PI student, as a Black PI student, I'm being told I can't get into a magnet and I'm being put on another track and put into sheltered courses for newcomers. Mm-hmm. So I don't benefit from that model minority myth the way some folks might. And so data disaggregation is needed to, at the very, very least, mm-hmm. be able to count more of our community so that we can advocate for resources on behalf of community, like the census. Every time the census comes around, NH and PI orgs mm-hmm. gear up heavy for that issue to make sure our community understands why the census is important and why we need to be counted. Because if we're not counted, there's no budget line items and resources
right.
being connected to our communities and our organizations. And we need those resources. We need to tap into every resource that could mm-hmm. be available. And so data disaggregation would help make that fight a hell of a lot easier. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we talk about just the needs for services when data is really dissected and uncovered. The umbrella terms allow for a lot of things to be pushed through, and kids are not getting what they need. One area that stands out to me when we think about K-12 is around the concept around suspensions. So you talk about model minority myth, talk about AAPI data. It's really masking the need. When you dissect that, you look at the extreme numbers of Pacific Islanders, specifically men, males, boys, that are getting suspended from school. You look at girls, and that's on the uptick as well. So what are your thoughts in terms of what you're seeing for school suspensions for Pacific Islander students?
Yeah, it's weighed, it's proportionate.
Yeah.
Most schools and districts, PI students might make up 1% or less of the population. And in several school districts, PI students, while only 1% or less of the overall student population, they make up more than 12% of expulsions and suspensions. And that's wild. That is wild. And I've seen it. I have witnessed an administrator walk up to a young PI student girl and make all the assumptions about how violent she is, how rude she is, how, and just assume that this student is physically going to become a problem and get suspended. I had a student who was breaking up a fight, who stopped a fight from happening. And the automatic assumption when the adult showed up was that it was the PI kid who might be look larger or look stronger. Therefore, it's her. She's the aggressor. And haul the kid off. The push out of Black girls is real. The push out of PI girls is real. And the number of PI boys, men, young men, who end up in prisons, especially here in California, it's wild. And it continues to grow. It's just, it's exponential for PI communities and has been that way and on the rise. I mean, for at least the last 6 years, probably longer.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. As you're talking, I'm thinking about how districts are able to mask it in the term that they use, statistically significant, right? And so if right now on our data dashboards, if a student group is not 30 or more at a school site, they don't get called out in the data reporting on the state dashboard. So going back to what you just said, our Pacific Islander students, there are not large quantities at our schools. And so they are masked by these policies, and we're not getting accurate data that's saying what's on fire right now, what are critical things that we need to be looking at. So I just wanted to reinforce that, especially for our K-12 educators that are listening.
Yeah, and I'd actually add, because data disaggregation and data equity is not a reality for us, most of those numbers are wrong anyway. So more than half of PI community members probably most likely identify as multi-ethnic or multiracial, myself included. And at some point in our K-12 experience, we were told to pick a box. And we picked a box.
Right.
And it is following us for the rest of our K-12 experience now.
Yeah.
And so I think of San Francisco school districts, some schools up in San Francisco that were able to, I don't know exactly how, I'm still trying to figure that one out, but recount the number of PI students who also identified as another ethnicity to make a case for PI specific programming, because there were tons more PI students in the district than they had originally thought. I think somewhere around 3 times more.
Wow.
The number of PI students they originally thought they had. I'm willing to bet that that's probably the case in many other large districts, and many communities where PI families have migrated to over the years. So I think about Seattle and Tacoma. I think about Utah, Salt Lake City. I think about LA, South LA, and now, you know, areas like San Bernardino, where more of our community are popping up. There may be more of us, and we have not been counted.
Yeah. One other area where there seems to be some invisibility is around ethnic studies. And you and I briefly spoke about that in terms of making sure Asian American students are getting representation in ethnic studies. We had a guest on our show that talked a lot about that and making sure you have the right people helping to develop that curriculum. But Pacific Islander, right? Oceania students, like, what's your message around people who are starting to create this curriculum?
Yeah, I think the first thing, I truly wish folks who are not ethnic studies would stop. Stop pretending to be ethnic studies. Stop claiming to be ethnic studies. Stop telling folks that what you have to offer is ethnic studies. I am a student of ethnic studies as a Black studies major, as an undergrad, and ethnic studies is a rich 50-year tradition and history of struggle and history of joy. And what I have witnessed are folks selling and offering curriculum and lessons and units under this, like giving folks the impression is ethnic studies. Mm-hmm. Because you have a lesson on Japanese internment does not equal ethnic studies. Right. A single lesson on Black Panther Party does not equal ethnic studies. There is a tradition, there is a pedagogy, there is a history. There are tenets and principles that must absolutely be present for it to be ethnic studies. And so my first and biggest fear, pet peeve, annoyance is folks who, first of all, are not educators, do not come from the classroom,
right,
claiming to have ethnic studies curriculum ready to hand out. The other issue that is concerning me, several states recently have passed legislation related to Asian American studies. Illinois comes to mind. First, there are several states who have been doing ethnic studies a lot longer and have stronger policy already written. California is one. Mm. Not where it needs to be, but we've been pushing for ethnic studies a lot longer than many other states. Arizona is another state with really strong ethnic studies leaders, and some policy is there as well to support strong ethnic studies programs. But what has happened recently is that legislation and policies are being put in place that preference one area of study over the other, mm-hmm. or language leaves little to no room for actual ethnic studies and prioritizes Asian American history,
right,
which is very different from ethnic studies or even Asian American studies, right? Like just teaching a few history lessons, again, does not equal the entire discipline.
Right.
So that is really concerning because we don't have data to sag, because we operate under this umbrella. If our Asian siblings are moving in a way with regard to education and ethnic studies that does not leave space or room for Oceania, that's not working for me. I think it's dangerous. And we could get to a place where NHPI educators and leaders on this front will have to do more to like keep pace. It's only now that PI and Oceania studies is beginning to emerge and break away from Asian American studies programs at the higher ed level. And so it's very rare to find it at the K-12 level, PI and Oceania studies at the K-12 level, and rare to find Asian American studies mm-hmm. in a true ethnic studies tradition. And so if we have to be able to make progress in a way that allows us all to show up in solidarity and as good relatives. Mm-hmm. We have to attack issues like this one with the total understanding that our liberation is tied to one another. And if I move in a way that is only serving NHPI folks and causing harm to another community, that's not actually a solution. Mm-hmm. It's causing more harm than good. And so I would urge Asian American leaders, Asian American siblings who are doing ethnic studies work or promoting Asian American studies to keep that in mind. And if you're not really doing work on behalf of PI youth and PI studies, then drop the PI.
Well, that was an amazing final word. You've left us with some amazing things to think about today. Heavy, but a lot. And I feel we've only scratched the surface. There is so much more to talk about and explore. So we're going to put a pause there. Maybe we'll have you back for a part two. Maybe.
Yeah. Happy to come back.
Love it. Love it. So we close out a little lighter because we go so heavy during the time. We like to close with some rapid fire questions to get to know a little more about you, the person. So if you would entertain me with these few questions, we're going to end on a little fun. Okay.
Yep.
All right. What's the last show that you binged and loved?
Well, I couldn't binge it because they wouldn't let me. But the last show my husband and I got into or caught up on was The Last of Us. And loved it. We are gamers. And I watched him play that game through the first time. And so it was a great series that came very close to the video game.
Okay. I just started episode one, so I gotta stay the course on it. All right. What is at the top of your bucket list?
I need to touch the ground in both of my ancestral homes. Mm. I need to get to Samoa, to Savai, and I need to get to Calabar, Nigeria.
Mm. What's your walk-up song?
Dang, that's a hard one. I'm gonna go with Tupac, California Love.
Okay. Something tells me it depends on the day. Your walk-up song might be different.
Definitely. But that one is always in my top five.
Okay. Who is your inspiration and why?
Oh, that's also a tough one. I am going to say my daughter, Kasima. Kasima Ari, named after my great aunt, Lola Marie. Kasima is... She is a whole lot. She's one of those 9-year-olds going on 19 and some days going on 27. But she's just way too smart for me. And I am really, really proud of the leader she is in the third grade. She started a whole union and everything.
Well, look who her mama is. Come on. Did we ever doubt it? Come on.
Yeah, folks say that, but I feel like I can't take much credit. She was born that way.
What would people be surprised to know about you?
I am actually really shy. And I don't like talking. And I do a whole lot of public speaking, and folks probably would assume otherwise.
Yeah. So when you get quiet, you probably really enjoy the quiet, right?
Yeah, I do. I really enjoy quiet. Yeah.
All right. Last question. As we encourage ongoing learning about our AAPI community, can you give us something, a recommendation to read, explore, or watch?
I am going to go with Anything by Bell Hooks. Because she teaches us to love radically and how to show up for one another.
Mm-hmm. I love it. Estella, thank you for this time. I see you. I appreciate you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to share with others or to rate and review the show. To learn more about CAPL, visit capl.org. Tune in next week for a brand new episode. Thanks for listening.